This is Mutant, and you're listening to Dialogues at the End of Democracy. Welcome back to Mutant. What we're witnessing today as the new year unfolds is not simply the destruction of human lives, whether through war or a murderous denial of the climate crisis or the increasingly venal forms of neglect of vulnerable populations worldwide. Rather, this moment marks what we have called before here at Mutant, the decomposition of the human itself, often within the boundaries of or presided over by those very formations and collectives we call democratic. How did democracy, which counts among its most cherished and certainly its most avowed ideals, the idea of equality, come to forge this unspoken, pervasive compact with inequality in which we sacrifice entire populations at the altar of our voracious appetites, our mindless and bottomless pursuit of the good life? As we begin this dialogue foundational to Mutant and to understanding our neo-democratic condition, we take a different entry point into the question of equality. Conventionally seen in terms of or measured in terms of our access to material resources, we try to excavate here in this dialogue the idea of moral equality, or what Aishwari has called in his profoundly important 2015 book, Radical Equality, the moral equal. Aishwari, I want to start by asking you, why does the question of equality not seem to preoccupy democracies the same way? Why in their public lives, in their protests, in their civic claims, does equality not take as much space and attention?
Yeah, I think that's a great point to begin with as we return to the question of politics as such. The problem of politics is not freedom in an abstract sense. The problem of politics, the problem that modern politics seeks to resolve or solve, is not of freedom. Politics is the expression of freedom. The problem that politics, and by politics we mean modern and by and large democratic politics, the problem that modern politics seeks to solve is that of equality. Its fuel, its conditions of possibility, the framework of its expressions, the paradigm in which this equality is articulated and sought, rests fundamentally on human freedom, on a certain understanding of human freedom. Now, here is where the paradox begins. We can, as we have often done in Mutant, we can find ways to articulate and define what freedom is, because we know what its disappearance might mean. We have said this before, but it's worth returning to that definition of freedom simply by reminding ourselves that freedom is both important and relatively easier to define because we live in the fear of its disappearance. We know what an absence or a lack of freedom looks like. And that awareness, that fear, that knowledge perhaps of the loss of freedom, of its disappearance from our world, allows us to articulate the resolute commitment to human freedom. We have said this in an episode, in our episode on fear, that this is what forges the profound link between fear and freedom. Now, what this does, this profound link between fear and freedom, is that it creates the conditions of politics. To be political is to not just think about freedom. To be political is the ability to think freely. Not just about freedom, but about the human condition at large. In many ways, these two elements of modern politics, one, the conditions of its possibility, that is, those conditions under which being political becomes possible for us, and B, its framework, its defining paradigm, which is freedom. These two things become easier to delineate or lay out. But what is the end of this politics? Why do we value freedom? Or if I were to rephrase your question, why is freedom such a convenient slogan for an entire spectrum of political thought, even and especially when they cannot agree on what the moral and political core and substance of human freedom really is? To what end do we want to be free? To what end do we need and desire this freedom, as Hannah Arendt would say, this freedom to be free? That end, I would suggest, that end of politics, whose foundation is human freedom, desires something else. That else, that need, is equality. Equality is the end of all democratic politics. Freedom is its foundation. We cannot be political. We cannot strive for a democratic world in an unfree universe. Which is simply to say, and let's read, the crucible of modern politics is freedom. The end of modern politics, that which politics desires, is equality. And again, by politics, we mean democratic politics. All politics ends in the accomplishment and arrival of human equality. And precisely because we don't know what makes us equal, given the fact that human beings are naturally endowed with very, very different skills, very, very different attributes, very different kinds of moral virtues, we do not know how it is really that we are supposed to make humanity equal to itself. The answer to your question about why freedom is a more easily mobilized concept, while equality is a more evaded and evasive one, is simply this. We know, through sheer experience, what the loss of freedom might mean. The loss of our freedom, the disappearance of freedom from our world, means the destruction of politics itself. Right? So, we can mobilize ourselves, our communities, societies, entire countries and polities around the idea of freedom, even and especially when this mobilization occurs around the fear of its loss. But the exact same thing becomes absolutely impossible for equality. Societies will simply not mobilize. And this too comes to us from the experience of modern politics. Societies will simply not mobilize around the idea of equality. The most common, most obvious, most stark example of this was the backlash to Black Lives Matter in the United States. That slogan seeks and desires the equality of Black lives to other lives. And it immediately generates a counterclaim, vacuous morally, untenable politically, and prejudicial socially. And that counterclaim was, well, only Black lives don't matter. All lives matter. When the conversation shifts to police brutality, another reactionary slogan appears on our horizon, which is Blue Lives Matter. And I think this is an important nub of the problem of equality, which is our sheer inability to grasp what an equal world will truly look like. With freedom, we know what its disappearance looks like. Its disappearance looks like absolute tyranny. What does the disappearance of equality from our world look like? Given that the only pure equality that we know of can be experienced only in the state of nature, not in a society. Given the sheer brute and cruel fact, societies, the moment they come together, become unequal. Given the stark fact that human beings leave behind the state of nature and come to inhabit a common world only and only when they surrender their moral relations to a certain kind of hierarchy. Equality is difficult to grasp because inequality is the structuring principle of modern societies. It's not always unrecognized. Remember, a 2014 Pew Research Center poll asked its respondents what the greatest threats to human life were. And ahead of nuclear catastrophes, ahead of environmental degradation, ahead of wars, a majority, a plurality of respondents wrote that inequality was the most catastrophic, the gravest threat to human life. So we know that inequality is destructive. But we do not know how to live without it. There is almost a love of inequality in societies that are founded on the principle, and we will take only one such principle, the principle of hereditary occupation. There's a name for that hierarchy. There's a name for that love of inequality. There's a name for that cruelty, shall we say. And that name is caste. A concept that is mobilized in critiques of inequality in 19th century thinkers like Jyotirao Phule, Frederick Douglass, coming down to 20th century figures like Ambedkar and Du Bois, and most recently in our constellation by Judith Clark. Each of these thinkers we think with has a name for this desire and love of inequality, caste. And we have said this before, caste is not just one system among others, caste is a paradigm of inequality. It is without any gravity, and yet it holds itself together. As Ambedkar says, like weed on the surface of a pond. It just hangs in there. Now, we know all these things about inequality. We can also perhaps, as a moral principle, state that this inequality is what makes equality so elusive. But unlike a free world, whose contours we can delineate and lay out, we simply cannot agree. We have not agreed ever on what the contours of an equal world would look like. And that is the paradox we must face. Freedom is susceptible to appropriation precisely because its loss is more palpable, its disappearance is scarier, and its accomplishment or its reality is what creates the conditions of modern politics. One could almost paraphrase Arendt here and say, politics is freedom. All politics is a politics of freedom. Equality is not susceptible to this kind of definitional, let alone moral clarity. Equality is messy. Equality is oblique. Equality can even be cruel, and equality for sure is a radical idea. The end of politics is this radical equality. And precisely because it's the end of politics, precisely because we strive for something we cannot fully define, articulate, or identify even, let alone agree on, that equality remains an elusive, sometimes opaque, and for sure an intractable political and moral idea.
You spoke towards the early part of your answer of the fact that equality is very hard for us to construct because of difference. And I think perhaps the abstraction that the idea of equality often seems becomes much more graspable, even tactile, when we think of it through the lens of grasping how to deal with difference without hierarchy. And I'd like to come to that just a little further, but to return to what you were alluding to, that equality is a desire or can be a desire, but it may not be a natural condition. Is it perhaps then accurate to say that equality is not something you can construct? Equality is the act of the destruction of inequality, not something you build, but something you sort of break down. There are ideas you think of as those that you build, and I'm just trying to understand whether equality is something that you can arrive at by destroying, or maybe, to use Ambedkar's word, annihilating inequality.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's the most succinct way of understanding equality as it appears in the radical democratic tradition. also in the constitutional democratic tradition, not as something whose form and future will be available to us in advance, not something whose entire epic story could be written out and then staged in the theater of human action that we call politics, but instead as that which first requires the understanding of what it is that human beings need. What it is, in other words, or dialectically speaking, what it is that human beings desire and need. The modern social question, as Hannah Arendt coins it, is simply the question of need. And insofar as equality, we were saying, is the end of politics, insofar as the fuel of politics is freedom, but its final frontier is an equal world, a society of equals, its form cannot be known in advance. Equality is radical precisely because it is always in the future. It always recedes from us in the present. And it's a very tragic and pessimistic way to understand the possibility of equality. It is from that tragic pessimism that Ambedkar appears to coin the expression annihilation of caste. Annihilation, we were saying, is not simply the rejection of the world as it is. Annihilation is also a responsibility to the world as it ought to be. An annihilation of caste is therefore, first and foremost, a treatise on this responsibility to a future that might potentially and finally be equal. But in order for that potentiality to be realized, a more fundamental truth about politics needs to be grasped, which is equality will not arrive by itself in the future. Equality will require force, the third and the sovereign concept in annihilation of caste. Equality will require force, a force that destroys inequality. Two things can be said here immediately. First, as Ambedkar himself would say, equality is in fact not all that natural. We've already hinted at that, so there's no need to spend too many minutes on this. It's also a fact of the human condition. All men, let alone men in relation to other species, are not born equal. We know this. And at some point, however, they decide it is just, that is to say, it is in the nature of justice for them to believe that they are indeed equal. The American Constitution argues that all men are born equal. But the founders knew they were not. Right? In fact, the American constitutional tradition is unique among modern constitutions insofar as it is also the first constitution that accepts this axiomatic equality without any ground. This is the second reason why equality must be seen not as simply a function of the law, of legality, of abstraction, but actually of radicality. Equality is the most radical thesis in modern politics, precisely because it's so elusive, and precisely because it can be understood only as a matter of an axiomatic principle. The grounds for it do not exist. Men just believe and decide to believe in the interest of justice that they are indeed equal, born unequal, but promise one another a promise that is given to themselves and to others that they must strive to become and keep themselves equal. And this intent is the beginning and end of politics. Politics cannot begin, and it certainly will not end in equality if there is no freedom. If there's no freedom to posit this principle. This principle that even a messianic Marxist Walter Benjamin would call a moral principle. In those opening lines of his 1921 essay, Critique of Violence, Benjamin says, the question of justice is a question not of law, but of moral relations. Which brings us to the second point. The promise of politics that being human, simply being human, requires. Simply the shared right to become equal involves. Is a curious acceptance of the state of nature itself, for it is only in the state of nature where each is at war with the other for survival. Each has the equal right to struggle and desire. Does true equality exist? That's the tragedy of man. Here, by man, we mean Rousseau's man or Hobbes's man. True equality exists only in that state of nature, in a war of all against all. Which is to say, inequality comes into the world as soon as a society comes together, extracted from the wild. What is natural now to a political society is thus inequality. And now that the state of nature of pure equality has been left behind, we must face the hierarchy of the law. A law that treats everyone unequally, despite itself. And that is not an equal world. Equality, or this equal world, must now be intentionally struggled towards, must be intentionally sought. Elsewhere, outside of politics as usual. This is the fourth way in which equality is radical. That it can be sought not within the normative banisters and confines of politics. It can be sought only outside of the scaffoldings that politics imposes, the inequality that politics and political societies impose on their citizens. And it is here that we return to freedom, the freedom to go away, the freedom to leave the city, the freedom to even conceptualize equality with freedom, all of which we call justice, is what makes equality so radical. And what I'm struck by now, having read it so many times in the last 20 years, is how radical a thesis of equality, annihilation of caste, which Ambedkar publishes in 1936, presents to us. Equality is not a matter of social reform. Equality is not a normative idea. Inequality is a normative idea. Equality is not. We live more normally when we live as unequals. We live more exceptionally, perhaps even fleetingly, when we see each other as equal. And that is what makes equality so radical. that it can be sought not as a matter of, let alone through instruments of social reform. Equality can be achieved only through a moral revolution. And that moral revolution requires an absolute freedom to act. The freedom, as Arendt would say, to be free. The classical distinction or the classical tension between freedom and equality is at best an act of bad faith. There can be no freedom without this radical equality. There can be no self-determination without this absolute commitment to equal lives, to conditions under which we can live as equals.
When we speak of, and when you were speaking of caste and you speak of, for example, occupations being predetermined, I think what we begin to glimpse is that it is the right, as you put it, to struggle and to desire equally, not necessarily the attainment. It is the right to reach for, or it is not necessarily that the unequal conditions cease to exist, but the equal opportunity to overcome those conditions exist. Is that what we might call equality?
Yes, I think that is where we part ways somewhat from Hannah Arendt's notion of the social question. Arendt, as we know, very famously equates freedom, human freedom, with the capacity to act. For her, being human expresses itself in action, vita activa. Equality for her comes down to the more social of these questions, which is the eradication of need, as we remember from her work on revolution. The social question for Hannah Arendt is human deprivation, and therefore its resolution depends on the eradication of need. Now, what happens here is Arendt sequesters action from equality. But if we are right in framing equality as a struggle, equality as a positing of a new moral revolution, equality as an expression of force, a force that will destroy inequality, then we do know that equality requires action. We become equal not because law has deemed us equal in an abstract sense, imbuing each human being with a certain kind of personhood in the abstract. There's nothing redeeming, as Hannah Arendt would write in Eichmann in Jerusalem, there's nothing redeeming in the nakedness. There's nothing redeeming and there's nothing sacred in the abstract nakedness of man. That's her expression. Right. Law makes us equal, but there is absolutely nothing sacred in that principle of legal equality. You know, where human beings living together or forced to exist together were most equal? In the concentration camps. That is where law and tyranny had subjected the European Jewry and other kinds of minorities, Muslims, Romas, Gypsies, to this abstract and brutal equality, pushed to the extremities of being non-human themselves. This is why Arendt, who's perhaps the most singular chronicler of totalitarianism in our time, can write that there is nothing sacred in the simple fact of being human and being equal. One can be equal and one can be absolutely human, in fact, non-violently so, in a concentration camp. There was no violence, no resistance, no action. Even though there was solidarity in the concentration camps. Which tells us something more about equality. That it cannot be a legal principle, an abstract legal or constitutional claim. Equality has to be desired and acted for, acted towards. And that action, its first station, and I'm using Lincoln here, its first station is the destruction of inequality that hereditary occupations impose on human beings. So, to your question about hierarchy and inheritance, there's absolutely no greater and no more powerful and immobilizing force on human beings than inheritance. It fixes you in the garb of stability. It nails you down to an occupation in the masquerade of security. It predetermines your occupation for life in the name of longevity of life. And that is where Lincoln refers to the spirit of caste. Right? American racism was animated by the spirit of caste. Around the time of the Emancipation Proclamation, Lincoln is very clear about the limits of that proclamation itself. Its purpose is not simply to create an army, a class of freedmen. Its purpose is to allow America to imagine a world in which your station, my station in life, was not nailed to my inheritance, that you could move. You could buy land elsewhere. You could learn a skill somewhere else. You could go away with freedom and with dignity. And that requires, interestingly, the destruction of the archaic norms that the plantation society had come to entrench. And as we often say, and it is worth repeating, there is a name for this archaic norm. There is a name for this degradation of human life and labor. And that is caste. The spirit of caste, in Lincoln's rhetoric, in Douglas, who also uses the expression spirit of caste, turns into a ghost by the time Ambedkar begins to come of age. In his, he's writing his MA seminar paper. And then his thesis, Ambedkar would write about the ghost of Manu, the lawgiver, a deathless ghost. No matter how much I try, he writes, this young student writes, I cannot kill him. That is how inequality haunts modern politics. That is why you cannot achieve, acquire, or even imagine what a society of equals looks like, as long as you are resistant to understanding how you are complicit in this pervasive, normalized, normative inequality. When we say radical equality, we mean the force needed to break through, to cut through this obdurate logic of inequality. That is what gives equality the force of a radical thesis in politics. Equality will not arrive simply by taking care of human need. Equality will arrive by first understanding why we are so drawn to its exact opposite. Why people, by no means affluent, decide to pose their faith in a few rich men on the planet. What is it about income inequality that compels and drives people to even greater love of social inequality? Why do so many who stand to lose the most under tyranny, under oligarchy, under kleptocracy, still decide to be pulled, willingly pulled into that delusion of an unequal world in which they will have some power still to lord over a few others? This world in which often the most deprived find themselves drawn to even greater and not lesser inequality is what we call the neo-democratic condition, where those who stand to lose the most seek some form of power that will allow them to return to an older past that simply does not exist. That's why it's phantasmic. That is why, to use Ambedkar, who uses Marx, it's spectral. This inequality is not simply systemic. It's not simply structural. It's ghostly. It's delusional. And it allows the world's majorities, vast majorities, most recently in the United States, to rally behind a cause that will make the world even more unequal. And that's because it is an inequality that the satisfactions and seductions of power reside. Equality requires acting against those desires. Inequality comes easily to us. We are unequal. And given a choice, we would rather live in an unequal world. In fact, we would choose extinction over equality. And that is what makes equality radical.
Is distinction or difference by its nature hierarchical? How do we start to conceive or theorize a way in which we can see our differences without automatically subjecting them to a filter of grades or graded hierarchies? And are there thinkers? Ambedkar is clearly one, and he therefore speaks of annihilation. Are there thinkers of difference we can think with here who find a way to think about it without subjecting it to hierarchy.
Oh, yeah. I mean, one of the most important thinkers on mutant for us has been Judith Sklar. And I think what, to me, joins Sklar with the likes of Ambedkar and Baldwin is precisely this theoretical and philosophical claim that you cannot think about freedom without thinking about caste societies, without forcing the stream of your thought through the South. The fact that Arendt and Sklar are both Jewish women who have fled Nazism and have a remarkably, dramatically illuminating, if that is the word we were looking for, experience of what totalitarianism really looks like. That they both come to the United States and become naturalized Americans. And yet, for all these commonalities they share, they never come to an agreement, let alone convergence, about what America is. Tells you how this country that is the crucible and the epitome, perhaps even an example of how to be equal in the world, or used to be, at least in theory and rhetoric, how they come to this country and write such radically distinct genealogies of American inequality or American stability, in Hannah Arendt's case, is a testament to the idea, firstly, of how powerful distinction, the idea of distinction, can be in structuring and influencing how we see equality itself. The desire for equality does not presume the end of distinctions. The desire for equality does not encourage us to see a world in which every human being is as abstract as the other person. There is nothing sacred about that. That is not equality. Equality is where everyone has the freedom to move out of their inheritance, of this hereditary world that they are born into. And yet we know that moving out, which is fundamentally a question of freedom, a question of mobility, a question of traversal of time and space, is not the only condition of equality. Equality needs something more. And this is where I believe Judith Sklar becomes a thinker of equality, and as she defines it, as a quest. Equality is the quest for citizenship. To be a citizen means not simply to have the ability, to have the liberty to move around, to leave your occupation or even place of birth. It is the ability and the liberty to create the world in your own image. And what is distinction, if not this ability to see the world through your own prisms in a manner that the world recognizes as your own? Right? Distinction is the ability to create your own world in a manner that the world recognizes back. And that is possible only in an equal world. That is possible only in a world that recognizes your difference from others. In so many ways, true equality can exist only when each is allowed not only the liberty to move, but the liberty to create a vision for their own future in a manner that is recognized by the world that it creates. And for these constellation of thinkers who cannot think of either freedom or equality without the South, without the global South, that awareness of distinction remains a profound, in fact, it remains a cornerstone of their political thought. One must strive to distinguish oneself, but one must also have the right to distinguish oneself. To be political, Arendt argues, is to become immortal through one's actions. It's a miracle, she says. Miracles do happen. It's a miracle to become someone you are seemingly not destined to become, but you do. And that, to her, is the end of politics. For Sklar, as for Ambedkar, it is not simply the possibility of miracle. It's your equal right to make those miracles possible that come before this imagined promise of the future, of justice. The most important connecting set of dots here is, of course, Hannah Arendt's famous expression, the right to have rights. And I think in each of these thinkers, equality is firstly the ability to create the world, to distinguish yourself and create the world in your own image without being punished for it. That is equality. That is why American Democrats, with a small d, those who stand for democracy, can argue that Black lives matter. Because Black lives are distinct. They are susceptible to the force of law in a manner that is deeply troubling and profoundly distinct from other bodies. And that distinction is what becomes the site for their claim and right to equality. There is no equality without an awareness of difference. Equality and indifference can never exist together. Equality can exist only when we concede and accept the sheer fact of our incommensurable, infinite differences. And that, again, cannot be a legal principle. Because the law institutes our equality in the most abstract sense. We know that the law in principle states we are equal under law, and yet we know we are not. Yet we know that its punitive instruments, its strategies, its power works on bodies differentially. Distinction is our ability to rise against, act beyond, and therefore overcome that inequality. Equality is the right to distinction, not a claim of sameness. And that is why I think equality is the most radical proposition in modern politics.
Before we close, I do want to touch on, it's at once tangential, but perhaps not because of how you think about the question of empathy. And it's a word we hear increasingly over the past many years, often as a way to combat or as a way to counteract the neglect and the negligence of those unequal to us and around us. And you have said that you see empathy as a ruse for mastery, often a reinforcement or a site of stasis and of inequality, rather than an emotion or an act that pulls people out of that condition of inequality. So tell me why empathy, this thing we are exhorted over and over again to show each other or to show others less fortunate than us, is to you a site for mastery?
In a very simple sense, and I like this question partly because it allows us to go back to Judith Clark's notion of ordinary vices. And one of the most underread, still underread, thesis about snobbery that Judith Clark has there is that at one level, unlike lying, unlike deceit, unlike hypocrisy, snobbery has a redeeming quality to it. It's a negative view of the world, but it is a very, very powerful way to understand what makes us associate so strongly with such strong bonds with one another. And one of the virtues of snobbery is not that it looks down upon others. One of the virtues of snobbery is that it gives people at least a figment of an imaginary bond around which they can come. It could be something as basic as your and mine common interest in coffee beans, in cuisine, in fabric, in music, in one particular instrument within a whole plethora of instruments that jazz uses. In many ways, unlike hypocrisy, snobbery has this redeeming quality to it. It allows a certain kind of association to emerge. But snobbery is also, for that reason, more toxic than hypocrisy. Because at the end of the day, as Clark writes, snobbery is also an art of making someone's inequality hurt. You don't simply degrade or deprecate someone for not knowing as much as you do about coffee or fabric or saxophone. In doing so, you are pointing to a whole universe of inequalities between you and them. Inequality of access to good music schools, inequality of access to good music teachers, inequality of access to expensive coffees, inequality of access to or ability to buy expensive handmade fabrics. In each of these, snobbery, on the one hand, makes your association with others of your kind possible. Hobbes would call it civic association, absolutely important to democratic self-determination, to functioning democratic societies. And on the other hand, in the same democratic societies, snobbery is also a fuel that burns on other people's skins. It makes their inequality hurt. Now, what happens in societies by and large democratic is that these two groups have to live together. They must coexist. And I've always believed that empathy is that moral passion. It's a passion. It's a feeling. It's a sensation that we feel towards those less fortunate than us. And we try and imagine what their life would be. But we don't need to, nor do we desire to change those conditions of life. Empathy is a ruse for mastery because all it offers is solace. And among all the things that consolation is, it is certainly not an ingredient of our equalities. Consolation is vital. Consolation to someone who cannot get into a good college is vital. But it will never equal their equal right to get into that college. Colleges where entry is regulated by a variety of means whose only currency is snobbery. Sports that only a few play. Skills that only a few can spend their school life developing. Compositions that only a few have the time and the resources and the wealth to learn by the time they are 18. To those who do not have such music schools and music teachers, I can offer consolation. But not only will I be unable to offer them entry, I will also prevent their entry. And that is why empathy is not simply inadequate. Empathy could in fact be a fuel for an equality-destroying mastery. That is to say, a form of mastery that politely destroys our ability to become a society of equals. Empathy is the polite form, is the civic form of coercion. You walk along with someone, but only as consolation, not as solidarity. To be equal, on the other hand, is to forge a common bond that is grounded in distinction. And by distinction, as we were saying, we mean the right to fulfill needs equally. And it is in that sense, again, that equality first and foremost requires the destruction of unequal access and of inequality as such. It cannot be acquired without a moral revolution. In our very awareness and understanding of what human need is, and therefore in the final instance of why we even exist together as human beings.